It is Sunday, May 12th, 2013, and this is episode 18 of the Defensive Security Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jerry Bell. And also, as always, the thoughts and opinions and stories I cover on this podcast are mine and don't represent those of anyone else, including my employer. My continued consumption of Simply Lemonade and Grey Goose vodka should also not be construed as representing either of those two companies. So first off, I'd like to say Happy Mother's Day to all of the hundreds of moms I know are listening to the podcast right now. Hi, Mom. Happy Mother's Day. So the first story I want to talk about tonight is about a court in Washington, which was compromised and had about 160,000 Social Security numbers and 1 million driver's license numbers lifted from its website. So the court is saying they can only confirm that 94 Social Security numbers were obtained, but they're being cautious and warning everyone in the potential population of 160,000 Social Security numbers and 1 million driver's license numbers that they potentially have had their information stolen. So this is becoming kind of a common occurrence because the method of entry for this breach was cold fusion. Cold fusion's been kind of a headache for a lot of sites recently. I suspect it's really one of those legacy applications that have just become entrenched and now there's really no budget to move on to something else, and so these things languish. They probably don't get patched very often because they most likely break when they are patched. But regardless, this apparently is a 0-day and there apparently is not a patch yet. And Adobe, kind of dovetailing into the second story I have, Adobe has disclosed that there is a 0-day and that a patch will be forthcoming. And right now they are advising people to follow their hardening guide, which apparently will help to mitigate the attack. So that kind of begs the question, why are there sites out there not following the hardening guide from the manufacturer? If, especially in the recent history of successful attacks against sites using Cold Fusion, if I were running a site using Cold Fusion, I sure as heck would have implemented the recommendations in the hardening guide. Now, again, there could be a possibility that the hardening steps potentially break the application and therefore it really can't apply without a major rewrite. And of course, all the people who were around when that app was written are now gone, so we can actually do that. I'm actually reliving some painful memories there, not speaking for the Washington courts. But in all seriousness, if you are going to run something like Cold Fusion, which has a sordid history, you really should be keeping up with this kind of thing. And further, you really ought to have someone who is paying attention so that you know that there is a problem and you don't find out when a million driver's license numbers go out the back door. Or I guess the front door in this case. Keeping up with the latest happenings of key pieces of software in your environment is pretty important, especially when it's something that's running on an internet-facing service. I mean, it's important everywhere, But if you have a system that's being banged on by, you know, everybody all day long, that's a pretty important thing to stay on top of. So, you know, hopefully everybody has a pretty good risk awareness program for their applications and is monitoring for alerts and advisories and patch warnings and 0 days, that sort of thing, so you're not surprised. All right, the next story. Similar story. Nginx, which is a very popular alternative web server to Apache, had a very, very critical bug patched last week. So there was some exploit code running around and some apparently malicious modules that could be uploaded using the vulnerability. That vulnerability was patched, I think, on Tuesday. I think this one is important, not because it's spectacular, but because I personally have talked with people who will go with some alternative technologies to Apache because they get uncomfortable with, you know, the constant stream of patches and vulnerabilities in something like Apache. And, you know, arguably any kind of mainstream software. So you could call these people maybe IT hipsters. They don't want to be using the mainstream thing because it tends to be picked on. Well, the problem is that the more nuanced and less common software often hasn't had the trial by fire that some of the more popular cousins have. And so, you know, while we're going to continue to see exploits against Apache, we're probably at a point where the bar is very high and there's going to be a fairly slow release of those, but something like Nginx, which is a relatively immature, again, relative to Apache, immature web server, is probably going to have some growing pains similar to some of the other more common pieces of software. And by the way, I don't mean that as a dig on Nginx. I mean, it is a really fantastic web server for what it's intended. You know, it is a lean, mean, screaming web server. And well, I think you got the point now. So that kind of dovetails into the next story, which is that there is a piece of malware running around on web servers. So previously, there's been stories swirling around about the C-Dorked malware, or otherwise known as DarkLeech, which randomly redirects people, or I should say visitors, to the web server to a site hosting our favorite black hole exploit kit. And it doesn't redirect everyone. It has some rules and will only redirect based on some statistics, right? So maybe half of the time. Plus, there's a configurable whitelist and blacklist of IPs that will be redirected and those that will never be redirected, so that you can, for instance, black out AV companies and security researchers from hitting your website, or maybe Google. And that helps the infection to persist for longer. It's also fairly interesting that the modules on the server actually primarily reside in memory, and so they don't leave any traces in logs or on the disk. So it's difficult for an administrator to actually see evidence that something's going on, especially if the administrator is somehow exempted from being redirected themselves. Now, there's some nuanced things about this piece of malware, in that, for instance, Apple iOS devices aren't redirected to the Black Hole Exploit Kit, they're redirected to pay-per-view porn advertisements. And Windows 8 machines apparently aren't redirected anywhere. They're just given the original pages, while Windows XP, Vista, and Windows 7 are directed to the Black Hole Exploit Kit. You know, again, assuming they're not in the blacklist, and you know, statistically, they're up for redirection. I think the frustrating part about this is that no one really knows how it's getting there. So it's not clear how servers are becoming infected. Now, I think it's probably pretty clear that Nginx servers probably being infected by the vulnerability that we just talked about. So given that we don't really understand how this piece of malware is getting around or propagating, it becomes really important if you run a system like this to tune your awareness to when something changes that's not supposed to. So that might mean that you run something like a tripwire or some other kind of file integrity monitoring system so that you can see when your Apache or Nginx or light HTTP binaries are altered. Sometimes detection's all you've got, and it's an important piece of the puzzle. All right, moving on. May 7th, this past Tuesday, was Anonymous's OpUSA. And many companies out in the world were running around with their hair on fire trying to prepare for the devastating attacks that were to come because, as Anonymous claimed, they were going to wipe the U.S. off of the cyber map. And they also said that, you know, unlike what happened with Israel, we really mean it this time. So it seemed a little discombobulated to me. There were people claiming lots of sites being compromised, but when you looked at the sites, they seemed very, very spammy to me. So you saw weight loss, diet pill websites claimed as compromised. There were lots and lots of .phs and .rus and .ros, many, many other country top-level domain names included in a list of, I think, 600 or 700 purported defaced websites. Now, I suspect that was just a cold list of systems that had been compromised in the past and really had nothing to do with OpUSA. Now, there were apparently a couple of local businesses sprinkled throughout the country that did get compromised and apparently attributed to OpUSA, but as far as I can tell, it didn't seem to rise above the normal level of activity of such kinds of compromises. And so that kind of raises questions about the veracity of these operations. Are they ruses by law enforcement? Are they really just the death throes of a increasingly disorganized and internally conflicted hacktivist group? One thing's clear, though, is that people still respond when Anonymous puts out one of these things. And so it's a little annoying because even though Anonymous didn't actually do anything, with obviously the caveat that apparently a couple sites were compromised, they actually did do probably some amount of economic damage because they tie up a fair amount of resources in law enforcement and government entities and in many, many private sector entities trying to prepare for, you know, the onslaught that never actually does come. And so my perspective is that the real teeth of Anonymous anymore are actually in their PR releases. You know, that's actually where the damage they can instill comes from now. They are able to get lots of people scrambling and spending lots of money on DDoS mitigation services and upgraded firewalls and things like that that, you know, maybe they should be spending money on anyway. However, it is creating some concern in these organizations that causes them to spend some money that they might not otherwise do. All right, the next article is from InfoWorld, and it's a editorial about too many administrators being problematic for security. And, you know, I guess I had counted this in those self-evident list of things, right? I didn't really consider that we needed to think and call specifically out that, you know, the number of administrators creates a proportional risk to your environment. But indeed, we have an article about it. I fully agree that the concept of least privilege makes a lot of sense. It still holds true. And you really, really need to be diligent about who actually requires what level of access. And, you know, based on the level of significance of your organization and the kinds of data that you have and regulatory oversight and, you know, other risks, you know, both internal and external, you may need to implement some much more granular controls where administrators don't have access to data elements, and those that have the access don't have the ability to perform administrative functions. And there are technologies that can help with that. They're usually costly and cumbersome, but, you know, if you have that kind of environment where that's important, it makes sense to invest in some of those technologies. Okay, moving on, name.com suffered a security breach and reset passwords of their user accounts. Now, I don't think this one is actually particularly interesting because there's not a lot of detail on how it happened. You know, we could maybe assume that it was the Cold Fusion exploit or Nginx or, you know, who knows. But to me, the interesting thing is that we seem to be seeing a trend of attackers going after registrars to target some of the registrar's clients. So if I want to, let's say, take out some large bank, it may be difficult for me to actually go after the bank, but it might be less difficult for me to go after their domain registrar, compromise their domain account, redirect their DNS servers, create some kind of a proxy in the middle, intercept login IDs, and bing, bang, boom, I can do my damage. So we haven't seen a big push for domain registrars to use two-factor, and that's actually a little surprising because it's one of the more important linchpins in the whole hierarchy of the internet. We're seeing high-profile Twitter accounts hacked on an almost daily basis now, so we know this is pretty easy to accomplish. While two-factor is not a panacea, it certainly does make it a heck of a lot harder. And continuing on with the trend this evening of really awesome segues, The Onion had their Twitter account hacked this past week. I have been a big fan of The Onion for a long, long, long time. And I thought it was pretty interesting. I usually work with my iPad streaming Twitter all day long, and every now and then I glance over at it and I see some kind of interesting thing. And I happened to follow The Onion, and I thought it was interesting because their account was compromised, but you actually couldn't tell that their account was compromised because, well, it's The Onion. But in the end, the Syrian Electronic Army, who has been responsible for hacking many, many media outlet Twitter accounts recently, also compromised The Onion's and started posting some stuff about, again, their normal fare of propaganda. But what makes this incident just spectacular is that The Onion wrote a dissertation on what happened. So we can probably assume that The Onion was compromised in a similar way to many of the other media companies, because again, the actor's the same, the outcome was the same. But they wrote a pretty extensive blog post on what happened, and I want to talk about that. And again, the blog post is linked from the show notes. I highly recommend you give it your own read. It's really good. So the story starts off with a number of Onion employees receiving fairly benign-looking phishing emails. And they're prompting the Onion journalists to go to a website that looks like a Washington Post website, but of course, when you hover over the link, it of course takes you somewhere else. And when you click on that link, you're sent somewhere that prompts for your Google ID and password. In the case of The Onion, they use Google Apps for most of their internal stuff, apparently. So at least one of The Onion's employees fell for it, submitted their account ID and password. Now the Syrian Electronic Army had it and logged in with that ID and password and actually started sending out a very similar kind of phishing email to other Onion employees with a valid Onion employee's account. So here's where it goes a little crazy. After The Onion realized what was going on, they sent out a company-wide email telling everybody to go reset their password. But of course, the attackers also had access to the inboxes that, or some of the inboxes that were receiving those emails. So they turned around and sent out their own email that looked very much like the first, except instead of the right link to reset their passwords, it took the victim to, you know, the attacker's site. And so now they were again able to capture usernames and passwords. So in this third round, apparently a couple more people fell for it, and on that try, some of the people who fell for it, or at least one of the people who fell for it, actually had access to The Onion's Twitter account. And from that point, the Syrian Electronic Army was off to the races. So what happened next was kind of funny. In a way that only The Onion can do, they started poking fun at the Syrian Electronic Army and posted a news article about how the Syrian Electronic Army was having a little fun before they were going to be killed at the hands of rebels. So at that point, the Syrian Electronic Army got pretty pissed and started posting emails that were in the inboxes they had compromised on the compromised Onion's Twitter feed. So The Onion's response to that was to go and forcibly change all Onion employee passwords. So something that I certainly never thought I would ever do in my life, I'm going to read 4 recommended security precautions from The Onion, and these are actually very good. Number one, make sure your users are educated and that they are suspicious of all links that ask them to log in, regardless of who the sender is. Number two, the email address for your Twitter accounts should be on a system that is separate and isolated from your organization's normal email. Third, all Twitter activity should go through such as Hootsuite. And I think the point there is that you want to rely on something like the OAuth token that's established between the app and the Twitter account so that you're not actually exposing the actual password to an attacker. And then fourth, and probably most important, is that you need to have an out-of-band way to communicate across your organization in case of an emergency. So, for instance, in this case, they needed to take a pretty drastic action of resetting all passwords across their organization. And, you know, that's difficult to do when those passwords are your email passwords, and so you naturally lose the normal way you would communicate with them. So anyway, I thought that was a really good story and had some good lessons. All right, the next story is the unintended consequences of forced BYOD. I would actually call this something different. I would rename it slightly to be the slippery slope of BYOD. This is an InfoWorld article, and the essence of it is that over time, we're going to see organizations taking a stance of not only embracing BYOD, but actually starting to mandate it, and for a number of good reasons. And I don't necessarily think that is wrong. I think that the author, is actually probably right on with what's actually going to happen. But honestly, I think most of the problems and concerns he raises already exist. It just manifests itself much more pervasively because now, rather than people wanting to use their iPhone, their personally owned iPhone, for work, now you, in 5 or 10 years time, you may be forcing, as part of accepting a job offer, that people come with their own iPad or whatever it's called at that time. And then what about all of the cross-pollinization of personal and business applications and data? And what about things like e-discovery and remote wiping and those sorts of things? You know, these are all very complicated questions, and in a lot of cases they're actually somewhat jurisdictional. So I really don't know what's going to happen. This is kind of one of those watch this space types of situations that, you know, we need to be cognizant of, because it is a real business trend that has business value. You know, as security people, we can say, you know, hold up, this doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, but realistically, the business is probably going to win out, and we need to be thinking about how to facilitate this. At the end of the day, businesses are in business to make money, not to be secure. And the final story for tonight is a story from CSO about Google's 5-year plan for authentication. So as best I can tell, and I'll admit, I haven't fully read Google's paper on it, but from reading the summary, it sounds like there's two main aspects to it. One is authentication bound to a specific device, which, by the way, sounds a heck of a lot like what Facebook does already. And the other is somewhat more interesting, and that is a variation of two-factor where rather than the current iteration of two-factor, which is basically usually an SMS delivered PIN, that PIN will actually arrive to a device like a smartphone and be delivered to the device that's requesting authentication via NFC. And the idea being that there isn't a opportunity for someone to intercept it. So you couldn't trick a person into reading the PIN number that just came in because it's not a human accessible thing. I think the one challenge I see with that is device consolidation. I mean, we're seeing more and more and more contraction and consolidation. We're seeing tablets get smaller. We're seeing phones get bigger. They're all getting faster, more memory, more capable, higher resolution screens, better interfaces, better capability of running business applications. I don't envision a future where we have two separate devices that would enable such a thing. But again, I guess I need to go read the actual report, and maybe they've already addressed that. But you know, the interesting thing is that Google, being the overseers of Android, are probably in a unique position to actually do something like this, where you know many other entities struggle to implement an infrastructure to do this. Well, that's all I have time for. You know, I probably had 30 more things I'd like to talk about, but you know, the hockey game is coming on. Actually, it started about 17 minutes ago. I've got another rough week ahead at work, and I need to get on to bed, so I'm going to call it a night. I hope you all have a great week ahead. Remember, hit me up on Twitter, @DefensiveSec. The website is www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find show notes. You can find lots of other cool stuff. I have, by the way, spent a crapload of time tracking down lots of different industry reports, and I have, I think, a pretty good repository of industry reports. So you know, take a look at those. They're always interesting. Some of them are more spammy than others, but you know, useful usually. Email me at info@defensivesecurity.org. Send me suggestions, ideas, topics, what have you. One of these weeks, I will get back on the bandwagon of reading books, and I'll have something to talk about there. But in the meantime, I bid you adieu. Have a great week. Take care. Bye.